like those indictments, it was really like a slap in the face. It just really felt like, you know, like, when are we going to actually receive justice? And in the eyes of many Flint residents, justice for them isn't getting their lead service line replaced, or, you know, today is actually the last day for residents to fill out their paperwork to be part of the civil lawsuit. It's not that. It's actually seeing someone convicted and going to jail for poisoning 100,000 of Flint residents. And then also, unfortunately, you know, the systems that created Michigan's emergency manager law is still on the books, and they're actually looking to tweak it because
Mayor, we have 15 seconds.
Okay, it's going under financial distress. So this is something that is going to be ongoing, and we have to continue to fight in the streets for justice that we deserve.
And we will continue to follow this, as we did with the documentary Thirsty for Democracy, The Poisoning of an American City. You can go to it online at democracynow.org. Nayara Sharif, director of Flint Rising, and Melissa Mays, resident of Flint and organizer with Flint Rising. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Isis Phillips. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is looking for our next membership director. KBOO's members are the heart and soul of our community, and we need a dedicated person to honor and foster this relationship. Are you the right person to steward and manage KBOO's membership department, or do you know someone who is? Go to kboo.fm to learn more about the essential functions of the membership director and the qualifications we are looking for. You can also apply by mailing your resume and cover letter to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Members make KBOO happen. Help us show them how much they do.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth exclusively on Pacifica Radio and its affiliate networks. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, today. Author, award-winning actor, and filmmaker Bill Duke joins us to discuss Dark Girls, a companion book to his 2012 documentary exploring the impact of color, the phenomena known as colorism within communities of color and in the wider society. Why is light skin favored over dark skin? What price do black women who are dark-skinned as well as light-skinned women have to pay? What is the impact on children? What about who is defined by the wider society about having good hair versus bad hair? Who profits from a definition of beauty that applies to less than half of the world's population? We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. NATO declared Russia the most significant and direct threat to its members' peace and security. It comes as the military alliance met today to confront what NATO's chief called the biggest security crisis since World War II. It also promised to step up political and practical support to Ukraine as it fights off Russia's invasion. U.S. President Joe Biden is vowing to beef up its military presence in Europe for the long haul, including establishing a permanent headquarters harbors in Poland, two additional F-35 fighter jet squadrons for the United Kingdom, and more air defense and other capabilities for Germany and Italy.
Together, our allies, we're going to make up sure that NATO is ready to meet threats from all directions across every domain, land, air, and the sea. In a moment when Putin has shattered peace in Europe and attacked the very, very tenets of rule-based order, the United States and our allies, we're going to step up. We're stepping up. We're proving that NATO is more needed now than it ever has been, and it's as important as it ever has been.
The war has already triggered an increase in NATO's forces in Eastern Europe, the largest since the Cold War. Allies are expected to approve a massive troop increase from 40,000 to 300,000 troops by next year. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky reiterated Russia is a terrorist state, this time during an address before the United Nations, which held a moment of silence for the 18 lives lost in a Russian missile strike that hit a mall this week, also injuring dozens more. Russia also partook in the moment of silence. Its ambassador to the United Nations said Russia was targeting an arms depot. Former President Donald Trump knew protesters with guns were at his rally on January 6, 2020, and didn't want the Secret Service to take them away ahead of the deadly Capitol siege, according to testimony from a former White House aide to the then president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows. The January 6 committee held a surprise hearing just days after announcing hearings would resume next month. Christopher Martinez has more.
Trump White House insider Cassidy Hutchinson painted a dramatic picture of events. Trump had made no secret of his plan to march with the crowd from the rally to the Capitol, where lawmakers were counting electoral votes. But that alarmed some White House insiders, like White House counsel Pat Cipollone.
Mr. Cipollone said something to the effect of, please make sure we don't go up to the Capitol, Cassidy. In the days leading up to the 6th, we had conversations about potentially obstructing justice or defrauding the electoral count.
On the morning of January 6th, Hutchinson says Trump was informed that some of his supporters had their weapons confiscated. Later at the rally, she says Trump was disappointed with the size of the crowd and upset about the magnetometers, or mags. Those are metal detectors the Secret Service uses to screen for weapons.
I overheard the president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away.
Hutchinson was backstage while Trump spoke to the crowd, telling them he would march with them to the Capitol. But in the end, Secret Service decided that was too dangerous.
The president said something to the effect of, I'm the effing president. Take me up to the Capitol now. To which Bobby responded, sir, we have to go back to the West Wing. The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel. Mr. Engel grabbed his arm, said, sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel. We're going back to the West Wing. We're not going to the Capitol. Mr. Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards Bobby Engel. And when Mr. Renato had recounted this story to me, he had motioned towards his clavicles.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Efforts to identify the 51 dead migrants found in a tractor trailer Monday night on the outskirts of San Antonio continue. 16 others, including children, were hospitalized. Ruben Minuti with the Mexican consulate visited those in the hospital. His comments were translated by Al Jazeera.
In general, medical staff at the hospitals, I insist, in general, have indicated those injured are in a critical condition, suffering from neurological, renal, and hepatic failure, as well as internal bleeding.
Bodies without identification documents, remote villages without phone service, and the need to share fingerprint data across borders and even stolen IDs are complicating efforts to identify the dead. Residents in San Antonio gathered at the site of the truck to call for immigration reforms yesterday. Activists, along with some Democrats, slammed the Trump-era Title 42 policy that bars migration into the U.S. under the guise of a health order due to the pandemic. Ghislaine Maxwell has been sentenced to 20 years in prison for helping the wealthy financier Jeffrey Epstein sexually abuse teenage girls. The sentencing Tuesday was a culmination of a prosecution that detailed how Epstein and Maxwell flaunted their riches and associations with prominent people to groom vulnerable girls and then exploit them. Those crimes occurred as the couple hobnobbed with some of the world's most famous and wealthy people, including Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, and England's Prince Andrew. Epstein reportedly killed himself in jail while awaiting trial. Maxwell blamed the abuse on Epstein and said meeting him was the greatest regret of her life. President Joe Biden's top health official said Tuesday every option is on the table when it comes to helping women access abortion in the wake of the Supreme Court decision overturning abortion rights Roe v. Wade, but he said there's no magic bullet to ensure abortion access. He said the administration would work to ensure medication abortions remain available, that patient privacy is preserved, and family planning care like emergency contraceptive is protected. South Dakota's governor has pledged to ban prescription abortion pills. A federal court has allowed Tennessee's ban on abortion as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy to take effect. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
That was our news headlines. We now go to our discussion with actor, author, and filmmaker Bill Duke about his brand new book, Dark Girls, a companion to his 2012 documentary by the same name. Bill Duke is often called the African-American godfather of American cinema and has worked in film since the early 1970s. He was recently awarded a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Directors Guild of America for his body of work that includes films like The Killing Floor, Deep Cover, and Sister Act II. Many will know Bill Duke from his numerous acting credits in films like Predator, American Gigolo, Car Wash, and Commando. Bill Duke is also known for his humanitarian efforts. He has worked extensively with the United Nations anti-AIDS programs and serves on the board of directors of Educating Young Minds, an after-school program aimed at assisting inner-city youth. We now go to our conversation with Bill Duke. Our guest is Bill Duke, and we're discussing a brand new book called Dark Girls, and it is filled with incredible photos of Black women, and we could tell by the title what the book is about. Bill Duke, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All righty. So, Dark Girls, dealing with a topic painful. If you're of African descent, living in the Americas, it is a painful topic of colorism, the prejudice the world shows towards darker-skinned people. But it's joyful. Its tone is uplifting and empowering. And women and girls, I know I want to get it for my daughter. Really, this is a must-have book, particularly with the holiday season coming up. Makes a wonderful gift to some loved one or friend. So, Dark Girls, Bill Duke, talk about your own experiences and why did you get interested in this particular topic?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me and thank you very much for your support. It's much appreciated. Well, I'm very dark-skinned and came up that way as a young man. Did not go to my senior prom, was not considered attractive, and went through a lot of that and rejection in terms of skin color. But through the grace of God and great parenting and mentors, I was able to overcome that. And it did not stop me from achieving things that I wanted to achieve, because I, through my belief systems, meditation, and my religion, I was able to dig deeper into understanding what true worth was really about, and not what someone thought about you. And as I evidenced the impact of colorism, as we call it, as racism within our own community, I saw the impact of it on young children, boys and girls, but particularly on young little, particularly at that time, dark-skinned girls who were called horrendous kind of names, darky, monkey, tar baby, and the list goes on. Having parents, in the movie, there's actually a lady who tells a story about her mother and her best friend are riding in the car, and she's with them, and the lady says, to her her mother says to her best friend, "Look at my daughter. Look how pretty she is. Nice nose and eyes and teeth. Can you imagine how beautiful she would be if she had any lightness to her skin?" Now, this is said in front of that child. Now, talk to the mother, and she means this. She how can I say, has no, in any way, intent to harm her daughter. But it is a belief system that we have in our community. And I wanted to be able to approach that in a way that was not condemnatory, but to explore why we think that way today in 2014, why we continue to carry on this thing, and are there any solutions? Those are the things I wanted to put forth. And so hopefully it's between the film and the book, there are things that explore, we call it edutainment, entertaining, but at the same time exploring why this still exists.
Yeah, and I wanted to just stay with that for a moment, because what you described growing up as a child and the young woman in the film, what may not be known to at least some of our audience, those who are not of African-American descent, is a kind of racism, one would say, within our own communities. I mean, I grew up in an island that was about 97% of African descent, right? That didn't mean that we were running the show. It was still the old plantocracy that ran the show. But certainly in that island, I mean, the differentiations by skin color, the gradations of skin color, the school I went to was integrated by my mother way back. She's passed away now 3 years ago. But she was one of three black girls that went to that school. But even at the time that I was at that school, it was still known for being a school with brown-skinned girls, right? And I remember there was a girl in my class who was very dark-skinned. And on top of that, she wasn't from the city. She was from the countryside. And people would refer to her as black. But we were all black. You know what I mean? And I think this experience is almost universal. I can't speak about the continent and how things are at the continent, but certainly in the Americas, North, Central, South, and in the Caribbean region, that seems to be the case. Bill Duke.
Yeah. Well, it's global. Mm. In India, the number one users of skin bleach is Indian men, because they want to marry women who are at a higher, how can I say, caste level in India. So if you want to marry an Indian girl, and this is happening today, if your skin as a man is dark, it is considered you work in a field. But if your skin is pale, it's considered that you have a higher status and you work in an office. And so men are bleaching their entire bodies.
That I did not know, although I have heard now that on the continent, in East Africa, South Africa, you know, bleaching of skin has gotten very big. But also in the Caribbean region, there were also, and throughout the Americas, there are the economic implications of it, because the families, the children, the black families where the children were lighter skinned, they were viewed, and this wasn't in a hateful way on the part of the parents, but of having a quote-unquote better chance of moving ahead than the darker-skinned children. So maybe they would benefit from that. You know what I mean? There were some perks that came along with being lighter-skinned, and then if you were darker-skinned, you know, it was felt, well, maybe you do the hardest work, or in the case of my village, maybe you would become a cane cutter or a you know, some type of laborer on the land, as opposed to getting a job in a bank or becoming a school teacher or some way making it into the middle class.
I think you're totally right, and I think that there are many. I just completed my film Light Girls, and and one of the researchers spoke of her grandmother, and she said that there is a mistake that it is considered that the reason that people in the times of slavery or just after slavery, wanted their children to be lighter and wanted their sons and daughters to marry light, was not for the sake of superiority or wanting to be white people, but for the sake of survival. And she said that many times her mother woke up and found darker relatives, men particularly, hung by trees with their genitals in their mouths, and that she felt that she saw how lighter-skinned people who were products of rape of black women from slave masters were treated compared to how dark-skinned men were treated. And so she, for the survival of her children, she wanted to marry light, them to marry light, not because of any kind of racist tone.
Yeah, and I'm sure that that story is repeated, as you say, you know, everywhere. And I mentioned my mother integrating that school. I should say that the three girls who integrated the school, I mean, my mother, I guess, would be what you call brown skin, right? Mm-hmm. But certainly she had some Dutch ancestry, right? My grandmother's father was a Dutchman, for example. You know, so she had that kind of skin tone. And mm-hmm. one of the other girls was extremely light skin. And the other, you know, so they were all, you know what I mean? None of them were really dark skinned. And recently in Southern California, our show, Sojourner Truth, we organized an event called Based on Black Brown Unity. And we had a historian, you know, come and talk about Mexico, African Americans and the Mexican Revolution, and revealed a number of people of Mexican descent that turned out to be Afro, including Emiliano Zapata, which a lot of people, you know, don't know about that. And they don't even know that there is such a thing as black Mexicans that are still around today in Guerrero and other parts of Mexico. But I was, several people were telling the story about how in their families that the lighter skinned baby, even among Mexican families or Central American families, like the lighter the children are, it would be like, oh, isn't she pretty? Look at how light she is, as opposed to a darker skinned Mexican that may, God forbid, have some indigenous or Afro blood. So that's a big thing south of the border in Central and Latin America as well.
Yes, and you're totally right on it. And the dark skinned girls, many we talk to, and it's never meant as an insult, but what's been said to them over and over again, "My, you are really pretty for a dark skinned girl."
Yep, have heard that one.
Now, believe it or not, that's not said with any harm intended. They think that's a compliment. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. As opposed to being you so black, right? You know, Bill Duke, it's and again, let me remind our audience, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our guest is Bill Duke, brand new book, Dark Girls. There's also a film about the book, so very important. And the topic of the book clearly in its name, and Judith Jameson says about it, quote, "Dark girls, celebrate yourselves, go beyond. Yeah. So, you know, Bill Duke, it's such a deep topic, and it is so painful on many fronts, because within the family, within the immediate family, within the extended family, within the wider community of black folks, let's say, mm-hmm. if you're dark skinned, you're dealing with a whole lot of stuff. And then, of course, in the wider society, where you see everything that's supposed to be beautiful, everything that's supposed to be good, mm-hmm. not black. Either white or, you know, the whole thing about if you're white, you're right. If you're brown, stick around. If you're black, stay back. Everybody knows that one, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting. As we explore this phenom, it's really complex and very deep in our community. On one hand, okay, it's a triple kind of thing. Okay, on one hand, you have darker-skinned women trying to straighten their hair and look as non-black as possible and sometimes lightening their skin. And then you have white women Botoxing their lips, getting butt lifts, and going to tanning salons
right
twice a week to look more ethnic. And then you have lighter-skinned women being used as trophies. I've actually heard black men say, as a light-skinned girl is passing by, I want one of those. Not the human being. I want one of those trophies, because if I have one of those, it makes me look and feel better. Now, you put that all together, it, to me, it's really an issue of self-esteem. The beauty business has somehow, we drank the Kool-Aid to believe that God made a mistake. But God doesn't make mistakes. How we are born is the way we were meant to be born. And whether you're black, white, yellow, brown, it makes no difference. It is the beauty of human existence. But when you have entities outside of your culture defining your worth, and you buy into it, and you do not have reinforcement in your home or in your community that says that's a lie, then you are victim to buying into something that's not to your benefit, but simply as a profit motif to get dollars for you to look like the thing they tell you you're supposed to look like.
Yeah, and you know, Bill Duke, author of Dark Girls, it's a beautiful book. The photos in it are just exquissite. Missy Elliott's Essences, Sylvia Obel, Lupita Nyong'o, who, of course, won the Academy Award in 12 Years a Slave. The children, the daughters of Steve Harvey also in the book, such an important topic. But you know, your last point is so well taken, because as a person of African descent myself, as a mother, I was a teacher, first getting out of college in New York City in Ocean Hill, Brownsville. And a lot of black children, Puerto Rican children, some of the Puerto Rican children, dark skin and impoverished community. And it would break my heart when my little first graders, they would draw pictures of themselves, and they would draw little white kids with blue eyes and blonde hair, and they'll say, that's me, right? And I get so, I'll have to tell you the truth, I get so angry sometimes thinking that, well, you know what? The whole beauty industry, and I'll have to put Hollywood in there,
yes,
that puts, you know, have no idea the emotional, and now it's coming out that these kinds of racist things have a physical impact on black folks as well, that somebody needs to sue these people and tell them, you know what, you got to make a drastic change, because it is harming our children, it's harming our communities, and whatever we do in the home to uplift our children, then they have to be out in the world and face this kind of nonsense day in and day out. When you turn on the television screen, you go to the movies, you open the fashion magazines, whatever the heck it is.
No, it is emotionally, as I observe it, as I see the harm it is doing.
Yeah.
As I see the harm we do to ourselves and each other, it is extremely disturbing. And I'm making these movies and I'm creating these books because, you know, I'm a filmmaker and I'm a writer and an artist. I'm trying to do my best to make a difference. But all of us, it's not enough for just Bill Duke. I mean, you're doing your job by, you know, having this thing put forth before the community through your show. But the average person has to step up. I mean, there's this attitude somehow, I don't know what it is, but that someone's going to come and save us. And you, there's nobody coming. So if we love our children enough, I remember a time when I was growing up, of course, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, you know, if my father said, to my sister and I, do not ride your bikes in the street, but on the sidewalk because of the cars.
Mm-hmm.
If Miss Johnson next door saw my sister and I riding our bikes on the street, she would come out, stand in front of us, make us put our bikes on the porch, sit us down on her couch, and call my father at work. And my father would say, I'll be there in 2 hours. That 2 hours was the longest 2 hours in history, because you knew what was going to happen. But the thing is that there was a feeling of community.
Yeah.
That we looked out for each other. I have no, something has happened that took that spirit from us. And we need it back, because collectively we have to do something. I'm not suggesting on any level I have all the answers, because I do not. But I do know this, that we are in trouble. I'll give you some statistics that are a little scary to me. They're talking about grandma, and the average black community now is 32. One out of four of our children are dropping out of high school before they graduate. Children that do graduate are reading at a 7th and 8th grade level, some of them. One out of four black men in Washington, D.C. is HIV positive. Out of all the AIDS cases in America with women, 70% are black women. I mean, I don't want to depress anybody, but I mean, I'm just...
People need to wake up and know what time it is and what's going on. And one out of four young black men are either in jail, in prison, or under the jurisdiction of the courts, right? And poor black people are poorer today than 3 decades ago. So I agree with you. I think we are in crisis. And I was talking to a young man out of Ferguson, Missouri, Tory Russell. He's been kind of making the rounds now a bit, the press paying some more attention, you know, this whole movement about Black Lives Matter. And I spoke to him after the verdict of Garner in New York, you know, the no indictment, and I was getting reaction with him. And he says, well, you know, I'm at the repast for Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old who was shot. And I didn't know this, so this is all live on the air. And I get his reaction, and then he says to me, he says, well, you know, Tamir's mother wants to share this piece of information. Can I tell you this, Margaret? I said, go right ahead. She said she did not have the money to bury her son, so she cremated him. Bill, I just broke into tears. I mean, in the background, you could hear me sniffling, because it broke my heart. This woman, her 12-year-old child killed, and then she don't have the money. And it goes back to what you were talking about how we took care of each other. And this young man ended it by saying that Tamir's mother said, what happened to the time when maybe your child was getting into trouble and a police officer would knock on your door and say, excuse me, but this and this and this is what happened to your child?
Yep, yep.
It goes right to the heart of what you were talking about.
We have to get back there somehow. I don't know how to get back there, but I do know if we do not, we it's a lot. We're in jeopardy, you know. There is somebody in the neighborhood should have said to that woman, don't worry, we got it covered. Even if everybody gave $5.
How is that possible? How is that possible? I mean, it's unconscionable. And I said, I was so taken back. I said, this must never happen again. I mean, not only his death and the way he died, but it must never happen again that mothers are left in that kind of situation. So I think that it's so great that your book and the film going along really showing the beauty, the black beauty, the dark-skinned beauty in such a positive light, because this has got to be part of the healing. Like every black child, teenager, yes, really difficult for the teenagers especially. You know, everybody, with the other thing I wanted to raise here, going along with the color, is also the hair. When I was in college, I actually did a little book called Peaches about hair and the good hair and the bad hair and who had kinky hair. And I actually had little samples of the hair, right? You know, that I glued onto the book with the message that kinky hair is beautiful.
Yes.
Because that's the other thing, right? Because you got to have good hair.
Well, you know, and who's defining good? You know what I'm saying? It is disgusting that our beauty or what is beautiful is being defined by an entity who's only doing it for profit. Because if you have kinky hair, we love you so much, we'll sell you products to straighten it. But first, you have to believe that your kinky hair is bad. And somebody in the household has to say, no, sweetheart, your hair is fine.
Yeah.
Somebody.
You're listening to Sojourner Truth with host Margaret Prescott. We're going to take a short station break. When we return, Margaret continues her discussion with actor, writer, and filmmaker Bill Duke.
Oh, here comes trouble. These people talk too much. Need to shut them up. Yeah, I'd rather be alone. Can you feel that rumble? All this borrowed time, it's been running out. It's the ending of the show. But I know now. Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. We now continue our discussion with actor and filmmaker Bill Duke, one of the authors of the new book, Dark Girls.
The book also, in addition to the beautiful photos, and this is the book, Dark Girls. Bill Duke is our guest, and he's, of course, the director, producer, writer, award-winning, considered the godfather of American cinema. And Sheila P. Moses also worked with Bill Duke on this project, and she has written 14 books, including The Legend of Buddy Bush, a National Book Award nominee and winner of the Coretta Scott King Award. She was the co-author of Dick Gregory's memoir, Callous on My Soul, and her first novel, Joseph, was nominated for the 2009 NAACP Image Award. And Baron Claiborne also collaborated on this, and Baron Claiborne's work has appeared in numerous publications, including Newsweek, New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone Interview, and his photos featured in museums and private collections throughout the world. So quite a team of heavy hitters. So the other side of this, though, that I did want to ask you about and get your reaction to is my daughter happens to be very light-skinned, and she gets hell in a way on both sides.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you know, yes. Well, you know, I just finished filming Light Girls, which is going to be aired on the Oprah Winfrey Network, I think the 19th or 20th of this month. And
wow.
January. Mm-hmm. And the story, okay, I'll give you one story.
Okay.
True story that one lady told us of her, when she was a young girl, she'd go in the bathroom, and the dark-skinned girls would chase her in, lay her on the floor, and take Nair, put it in her scalp, and pull her hair out by the roots.
Ooh.
The whole side of her head is blood. And why? Because they thought that she thought that she was cute because she had long hair. Okay?
And likely she felt just the opposite.
Yes. She felt tormented by the fact that everybody's looking at her, making assumptions about her. So the light girls film deals with this madness. See, pain is pain, you know. No one has a lock on it, you know. And as shameful as it is, we do things to each other that are as equally shameful on both sides of the color spectrum. It's really amazing. I'm so glad you did that.
I'll have to tell my daughter to watch it, because she went through, so she ran for she was a long distance, I think a 1500 runner in a track club, that met in South LA. And she certainly, got some hell because her, she has a kind of curlyish kind of hair, and was lighter. So it's like you can't be fully accepted as Black. And she clearly, she's so proud of her heritage and so proud of being Black. And God forbid anybody should ask her anything about it, because she, that's just how she is. She's her mother's child. But anytime you raise that issue, she herself has told me this, that you feel like, well, you need to shut up, because you do have, that thing. People do think you're cuter because you're lighter skinned. So I don't even want to hear about any issues you might have.
Yes, because you're privileged and you don't have any problems. Well, it's a lie. It's a lie.
Yeah, it's a lie.
It's a real, something that I think has to be discussed, and I hope continues to be discussed, because unless it is discussed, our kids will continue to suffer. And these are scars that, they don't just go away. These are scars that are deeply embedded into the very psyche, up into your adulthood. So
yeah, it just doesn't go away. The other thing too, Bill Duke, I saw something, I think it was CNN, Anderson Cooper or something, and they did some survey with little kids, and they showed them pictures, and the kids had to identify which were the ones they liked or which they thought was good and the other ones they thought was bad. And these little kids, white kids who had very liberal parents who would like in no way say there's anything racist in our household. But these little kids were pointing to the darker skinned ones as the bad ones, right?
Yeah, of course.
And the ones that they like were the lighter skinned ones. And the parents were like outraged. It's like, where does this come from?
Media.
Yep.
These kids are watching the internet. These kids are watching. Do you know that there is a Black rapper casting a music video that he was producing that said, no dark skinned girls need apply?
What?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Famous rapper. No dark-skinned girls need apply.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So, this is the kind of craziness. So, who do you have dancing? Light-skinned women, and they think that they really raise the stakes if it's somebody from out of the country, like if it's a Brazilian woman or something. That gives them status, the rapper, some status. And my assistant is a dancer. One time she said that they let the dark-skinned girls, dance in the background, but the light-skinned girls moved to the front when they were doing close-ups. So it's...
Wow.
These are rappers doing it. So if a young girl sees this, or young boy sees this, they're placing their value on what beauty is based upon, because in media there's two sins. One is the sin of commission, which is they actually, through buffoonery or some just negative statement, say that you are stupid, ugly, or whatever it is. Then there's a sin of commission. That's the sin of commission. The sin of omission is whenever there's anything of value, beauty or integrity, you're not there. It's much more subtle, but it's profound.
Absolutely. And, the story about the rappers, it's, again, in time I spent in Central America, like in Guatemala and places like Venezuela, et cetera, they would put ads in the newspaper for, let's say, a bank teller or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they would say, good appearance.
Yes.
And that's code, right?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. So that means you dark, you don't even need to come on in here.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And we found out that in India, when there's a bride or a groom, they have these ads in papers and people actually go to these ads, and at the top, it says light and fair. What this means is that if a family wants their son to get married or their daughter to get married, they look at these ads. If it does not say light and fair, there is no response to the ad. Go online today and look under hashtag team light skin and hashtag team dark skin. You'll see each of them has a minimum of 350,000 members. 2014.
Well, I'll have to say I was so happy seeing your face on the screen, Bill Duke. And, you know, because it was just a validation. I mean, I'm looking at Lonnie Love's statement in your book. She's a comedian and actress. And she basically says that she didn't want to change the color of her skin, that she knew and understood that she wasn't like skin with long hair. She always wanted to be a comedian, but that she had Cicely Tyson and Esther Rolle to look at. So that, you know, people don't understand the importance of seeing somebody like yourself on the screen and the breakthrough that people like you made.
I'll never forget two black women that changed my life and my understanding of beauty. One was an unfortunately unforgotten to a certain extent hero, Nina Simone.
Oh,
remember
she's
Nina
fabulous.
Simone?
Oh, yeah.
On her album with natural hair, and then Miles Davis at the time was married to Cicely Tyson, and she came out on the album with a natural.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I was going with a young lady living in Brooklyn, and she saw the album, loved the album, and went to the beauty salon and had all of the straightening taken out of her hair, and so that her hair was a short afro.
Wow.
She came home and showed it to her mother and father, and they had a fit.
Whoa.
What are you doing to our family? You nappy-headed so-and-so.
Uh-huh.
And they walked her back to the beauty salon and straightened her hair.
What?
Yes.
Well, I must say, I'm not surprised. I mean, I'm saying what, but, you know, all of us know about those kind of stories. Yep.
Oh, Father, you know, and they're saying they're trying to protect her.
Yeah. Yeah. Just amazing. And the thing about the hair, I mean, you know, we talked about, because these days your hair got to be so straight. I mean, it's got to be straighter than, you know, like a Japanese woman, right?
That's right.
And the amount of money that you have to spend, you know, with that. And when my hair are locks or dreads or however, you know, people want to refer to them. And people were like, Margaret, are you sure you want to do that? I mean, you're in media. What if you have to go on television or some such? It's like, you know, people are actually raising this stuff with you, you know, impact on getting a job and image and everything else.
A friend of mine that I know just got her hair done by Beyonce's hairdresser. The best extensions you can get, it cost her $9,000. And every 4 months, she has to spend $2,200. You know why? Because the hair grows. And so you can see the roots.
Those kinky roots. Dead giveaway. Dead giveaway. And Bill Duke, I mean, this is the thing about it, because getting back to Tamir Rice's mother and not having the money to bury her child, I mean, you know, you are trying to do what you can, and the two films now, you've got the book, and by the way, I just want to remind our listeners, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our guest is Bill Duke. This brand new beautiful book, Dark Girls. It's also a film, but you know, I rarely do this, but I'll have to say that for those of you who have not finished your holiday shopping, whether it's Kwanzaa or Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate or you don't, this would just be an amazing book for young girls, teenagers, and women of any hue, black, white, Asian, because Bill Duke, it's like you have Asian people who are trying to get their eyes fixed.
Yeah, that's right. It's not funny, but when you think about the irony, yeah, it's just so insane, you know?
You know, and isn't it though? You know, so you got white folks sitting under a machine that may be unhealthy to get brown, or sit down in the sun, risking maybe getting sun cancer. And
right.
You got Asian people trying to get their eyes fixed to look more white. You got Africans, you know, and people from India, you know, lightening their skin. You think the whole world has gone mad, right?
It's insane.
Yeah.
It is totally insane.
Yeah, but we really do have to do, you know, what we can to get this out. And the thing also about your book, I mean, we're talking about hair and all that sort of thing, but certainly there is no judgment. I mean, there are women in your book with straight hair. Mm-hmm. There are women in your book with kinky hair. There are women, I'm looking at Fladetta McAfee, who's a communication strategist, really dark skin and just absolutely stunning, right? And proud of her dark skin. And then you have, you know, Vanessa Williams. You've got lighter skin folks as well. So that there really isn't judgment at all, which is really, you got skinny women and you got some hefty women, right?
Everybody's there. Everybody
is there. So what was some of the reaction to somebody like you, given your field, going into doing a book like this? But I do have to ask you that we are living in a time now that young people, multiracial, are out on the streets saying Black Lives Matter. And I think that this thought and this coming of consciousness around that has to do in part with the message in your book.
Yes, I have very strong but controversial feelings about this issue, because I think that I always tell my daughter, you know, I said, men usually treat women how they see women treat themselves. And I said, never let a man treat you less than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the same thing with communities. People treat you the way they see you treat yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had many arguments about this, but, you know, on Labor Day weekend, I think it was, in Chicago, they call it Chirac now, over 82 black people killed each other. I really would have liked to have seen some marches, not to diminish anything that's happened, because I'm totally appalled by a 12-year-old child being killed and they were told he had a BB gun, a man being put in a chokehold that's illegal, a man that's shot and they say he's been shot, but he's charging you, and people do not charge these officers with anything and they get off. That's given permission to continue these atrocities.
Absolutely. Yep.
And at the same voice, when we kill 82 of each other,
mm-hmm,
in one weekend, my thinking is that these racists' attitude, and they're not being funny, their attitude is, what's the big deal? You guys killed 82 of your own. I just killed one. And I applaud what they're doing in these protests, but I would like to see as much of this energy placed within our own community, because we are killing each other every weekend. I mean, in LA, 12, 13, 14, you know, kids die. And it's almost as though the response is like, well, that's the way it is, you know, we just, but I'm saying, you know, this is our future. Our future is killing itself, and this is okay?
Yeah.
And it's not a white cop doing it. It's this kid saying, this is my, he's talking about some turf, whatever he means by that, that he does not even own.
Yeah. And the kind of self-hate and disregard and feeling of powerlessness and of frustration and everything that goes along with all of that, you know, it really breaks your heart. And as you said earlier in our discussion, you know, we do have to start caring for each other, and something has got to change, because every life is of value. And as you say in the book,
late, or do you think there are things we can do? I mean, I ask that question because it's, to me, it's an urgent matter. And my second question to you is, and I think about this, that's why I'm asking the question, from a legal civil rights standpoint, integration was a wonderful thing, you know, because it was more inclusive, you know, in terms of just legally. But was integration a great thing for our community?
Well, you know, Toni Morrison writes about that. I'm trying to remember the title of the book in it, because this whole thing about at the time that we were all forced to live together because we couldn't live anywhere else, and it meant that we were living together across sector, meaning the school teachers were living in the same community or across the street from the ones who were, you know, maybe the janitors or the more blue-collar workers, the middle class and the more, quote-unquote, and I put that in quotes, working class, were all there. The doctors, you know, maybe they lived in a bigger house, you know, on the block, you know, and I remember in Brooklyn they had a place called Preacher's Row. Remember Preacher's Row over there on, I think, Carroll Street or something like that. But nevertheless, people were close together in the community. And post-integration, you find a lot of the black middle class having fled the community and not looking back. And the ones that are left are those impoverished black people that I mentioned earlier that are more impoverished today than 30 years ago, even though we do have more of us now in the halls of power. You've got the first black president, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And how that translates for the ones at the bottom, you know, not that well. And one thing that I would mention to you, one of the things aside from the work I do here at Pacifica, is that I had been working to try to bring exposure and justice to somebody or some people running around killing black women in South LA with a serial killer. You know, Bill Duke, it could be as many as 200 women starting in the mid-1980s. And hardly anybody knows anything about it, right?
Is this person still killing women?
Well, the person they have in custody, they call it the Grim Sleeper, they found DNA for him with 20 of the killings. They're charging him with 10.
Black?
The other, he's black, lived in the neighborhood, and was going around going after so-called crack addicts, right? You know, crackheads, strawberries, you know, because there's a layer in our community that somehow their lives are they're even worse, worth less than anybody else. If they're a prostitute, they're a crack addict, they're if somebody's running around killing them, maybe they're cleaning up the streets, you know what I mean? As opposed to having, you know, that kind of devaluation of human life. But we've been pressing on this, and there's a film out now about it. I could tell you, Tales of the Grim Sleeper. It's actually shortlisted for the documentary. And black folks and because it has been so hidden from the media, black folks in Hollywood, I'm sure, don't even know about it, right? It's just because if people knew about it, they would be absolutely outraged. Bill, this has been in a 40-mile radius in South LA starting in the mid-1980s.
Wow.
It's a sad situation. Children are left, you know, their mothers, grandmothers raising their grandbabies. But what makes me really hopeful, and you asked if anything can be done, you know, about this. And I think that the movement that we're seeing now, that the young people who are coming up, that it's not only black youth that are out there saying Black Lives Matter, but it's Asian youth, it's white youth, It's old, you know, some older people. It's a multiracial movement. And I think it's, you know, we're at a moment right now, and it remains to be seen if we can take it in the kind of positive direction that you've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. It's imperative. It's imperative because I saw the same thing. And because people don't realize that the civil rights movement would not have happened without the Jewish community and the white community. Many Jewish
people
killed. Many white people sacrificed their lives also. And that means the nation came together. When they saw what was happening after that Birmingham bombing, human beings responded.
Yeah.
And I hope that that's the same movement that's occurring now, because it's like the old, you know, Jewish proverb of, when they came for Miss Kowinski in the next block, I said nothing. And when they came for Miss Benowitz on my block down the street, I said nothing. When they came for Mr. Horowitz in my building, I said nothing. And when they came for me, there was silence.
Bill Duke, I'm looking at the time, and it's just flown by. And I really hope we get to speak with you again. You've got your new film that's out. And is that a film? Is it a book also, or just a film that's coming out?
The film
Light
comes
Girls.
Out January 19th on Oprah Winfrey's network own. It's called Light Girls, and it explores the horrors that white-skinned women go through, as well as dark-skinned women. And the message is hopefully that we will just continue this colorism and self-hatred within our community. That's
right.
Our hope, and let our kids have a better life than we've had.
And this global phenomena. Well, I really hope that you will have some time to be able to speak with us again and continue this conversation. It's been really wonderful, Bill Duke, that you did this work and to be able to speak with you, and want to thank you for the breakthroughs that you have done and the way that you have made for others. Thank you.
Well, God bless you, and thank you so much for having us. I just want to thank, you know, the folks at HarperCollins and Chase Sherrod and others who have made this book possible, because without them I wouldn't have it. And hopefully people will check it out. And for your kind of support and people like you, I really celebrate you, because you're conscious and you care, and that's very important.
All righty. Thank you so very much.
God bless you.
I would like to thank our guest, Bill Duke. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Thank you for listening.